for the first paper of the afternoon session, we will have me giving this paper about our rule-based part of speech dagger. Maybe the general context is there are two kinds of part of speech daggers, rule-based and statistically based. In general, in the long run, the statistical ones are supposed to work better because however you formulate a rule, there will sometimes be exceptions. But a good statistical model will be able to sort of model the kind of intuition that a reader gets by reading a lot of texts, knowing, oh, well, this is a strange circumstance, so I'll do things a little differently. The trouble is good statistical models rely on an enormous amount of data that's already been correctly done. So we need to get to that point by having human beings do tagging. So we understand our rule-based tagger as a way to speed up the process of the human being tagging. So we let the computer make all the decisions that are totally mindless, and then that leaves the mindful decisions up to the people. So, this is again our goals, just keep those in mind. The corpus and the two pieces of software, the word breaker and the part of speech tagger. And here we're focusing on the part of speech tagger. We've actually had more trouble making progress on word breaking. Basically, we have a statistical model. It works reasonably well, but it uses very fancy statistics, so we're not really very able to improve on it. And we hope that it will just get better with more data that it's exposed to. So here, part of speech tagger. I'll look first at the workflow of the project, then give an example of one type of rule that we have in the software. I'll look at the syllable so, which can either be the finite verb suffix after verb stems that end with s, something like lasso, or it can be a noun tooth. So that's just a simple example. Then I'll look at how we handle negation and differentiating the negation markers me and ma from the nouns me and ma. And then the main focus of the presentation will be about disambiguating verb stems, and you can, you know, maybe anticipate that me and ma feeds into that. Okay. So this is a sort of mock-up of what goes on inside of the computer. So the first thing that happens is we already have the Tibetan that's word broken, and then the computer looks up every word in two places, in my 2010 verb dictionary and in its own memory of texts it's already read, and it assigns all possible interpretations to every word. So here you see galpo, it only knows is a noun, but then de, it knows is a demonstrative, so that king, or is a what the semi-final converb. That, you know, like in a verb like kill, you would have se de. It doesn't know which one, because at this phase it's just putting all possible analyses up there. And then also for la, it thinks, oh, could this be the allative case marker? Or maybe it's the noun mountain pass. Okay. So then we run the software, and the software is able to get rid of the semi-final converb interpretation of the de. The reason why is because there's a rule in the software that knows that day, the semifinal converb, has Sunday interactions with the preceding word. So because galpo doesn't end with a da and isn't a verb, although, you know, day can actually come after nouns sometimes, it gets rid of that interpretation. But it leaves the law because it's very hard to formulate a rule. We haven't been able to do it. We've been able to do it in some very specific circumstances. But in general, it's hard to preclude the interpretation of law as mountain pass. You know, the noun mountain pass can come after verbs. It can come after noun phrases, before noun phrases. You know, it's very hard to preclude this law meaning mountain pass. So the computer can't do it. So we pass it over then to the human being, and the human being deletes that out by hand. And as you can imagine, a lot of our hand tagging consists of deleting the interpretation of mountain pass. Then, after you do a section, so first computer applies its all possible interpretations, then computer weeds off the incorrect interpretations, hands it over to the person brings it down to one word, one analysis, then it's fed back into the computer, and then the computer reruns the tagger over the new material, which is basically to look for errors in the human being's work. Also, we're always adding new rules to the rule-based tagger, so maybe it will be able to raise the standard, if you like, of the work of the human being. And this is what we call the rule suggestions. So on the right, you see analyses that are in the system, that is, they're approved by a human being. And on the left is what the computer wants to change it to. So it thinks we've made a mistake, it wants to change it. And then the best way I think of understanding this screen is it's actually pointing out a human inconsistency. The machine is helping us to realize a human inconsistency. One are the rules we've taught it, and the other one is the specific interpretations of the passages in practice. So either we have formulated the rule incorrectly somehow, and the interpretation in the textual passage is correct, or the rule is correct, and the interpretation of the textual passage is incorrect. And this is something I do a lot, is go through these and decide, is the computer right or was the human being right? I'll focus in on one example in particular. So this, so a while ago now, is where there's a noun that it wants to change to a negation marker. So if you look at it in context, it's me, and it's in front of sok. So this sok is a verb. We know it's a verb because it comes right before this ching, and ching only comes after verbs. So the rule that sort of triggered it is the rule-based tagger sort of goes through a set of protocols looking for me, meaning person, and then if it hasn't identified that me means person, then it looks, and if a me occurs before a verb in the present or future stem form, it interprets it as negation. So here, nothing else has triggered the interpretation of it as person. Then it sees that it's the following word is a verb in the present or future, so it says it must be negation. Well, this is wrong, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a clever mistake to make. It's, you know, you would get half marks as a student. And what's going wrong here, I think, is that sok is not a normal verb. Yeah, it means to be, etc. Yeah? and it's much more usual to say people, etc., than to say not, etc. Not, etc. is a kind of strange idea. Yeah. So basically what our approach has been, in cases like this, where, for instance, we have another similar example, where we have ma shi, meaning mother died, rather than didn't die, is we then just add into the rule, okay, apply this rule in general, but not before sok. And then, of course, that weakens the power of the rule over time, right, the more exceptions we write in, but it increases its accuracy, so, you know. So now the example of so, just how we sort of, this is meant to be a very straightforward example of how we formulate these rules. So we want to find so as a finite verb suffix. How would we go about doing that, Marta?
Before she?
Before, you actually, yes, but you've jumped ahead of us. So, the thing I tell my students is after a word that ends in S, yeah? Because, like lasso, it's because the la ends with lax, so that it's not do or to or something else, yeah? So, maybe that would be our first try. But then we run into a sentence like, oh yeah, so the rule is after an S. But then we run into a sentence like this, which I made up actually, so it's not quite fair, where the so means teeth, even though it comes after a word that ends with an S. So this will be a false positive. So that's, you know, not the ideal formulation of that rule. So then this is where we take the before a she part. If the so comes after a word that ends in S, and is before a she, or some syllable that ends a direct quote like ser or nyam, then we say, okay, there it really is the finite verb suffix. And that seems to be working so far. Yeah, maybe there's a tooth out there that's going to throw us off, but we haven't found it yet. And now you can imagine, having formulated this rule, how we formulate similar rules for other syllables like lo and ro. You know, so lo can be year, or it can be the finite verb suffix. Ro can be corpse, or the finite verb suffix. And then de, which you saw earlier, shing, yeah. So we put in rules for all those things. So those ones are sort of not, let's say, intellectually interesting, because they're essentially lookalikes. You know, okay, lo, it means year, and it also is a finite verb suffix. Now we turn to mi and ma as, so we're trying to distinguish them as nouns and negation. So the first stab we make at it is that these, as nouns, they have noun phrases. So you have things like mi di and mi sum and ma gemo. So head, I mean, we can't just tell the computer if it heads a noun phrase, yeah. But we make that more explicit, like if it has an adjective after it, if it has a demonstrative after it, then it's person. Oh, and then you might think, and otherwise, if it's before a verb in the present or the future, then it's negation. But things aren't quite so simple. So for instance, we have this sentence, and this one's real, this is in our corpus. So, mungpa, I can't quite read it actually. Mungpe mi dro, so a crazy person went. So if your rule was just me in front of a present or future means negation, this would be marked as negation, and that's incorrect. So what is it that's triggering our knowledge as readers that this is a noun? I would say it's the preceding genitive here, right? So then we say, okay, before you apply that rule about me before present or future, say except if there's a preceding genitive. So that's, you know, so this is what these are sort of, you know, cycles within cycles. We add a new wrinkle to it. But then we try that and it doesn't work, because we have something like this where we have me before a verbal noun in the present or future and a preceding genitive, but this genitive is governing this whole noun phrase, mi gewa. So the me here is negation. So if you formulated the rule the way I just put it, this one would come up incorrectly as a person. So then you think, well, why is that? The reason why is because in a verbal noun situation, it's possible to have a preceding genitive, which is the nouny part, yeah, because the genitive hooks two nouns together, but also to negate it because it's a verbal form. So then we don't apply the rule about the preceding genitive to verbal nouns, only to finite verbs. And then we think, okay, now we're getting somewhere. But then you have a case like this, where the me occurs directly before a verb, and directly after a genitive, so it's not a verbal noun here, it's a finite verb, but the me is still negation, it's not the noun, person. Why? It's just an idiosyncrasy of the verb rik, to be proper, or to be suitable, that it governs the genitive. So then we have to just say, okay, all those rules that we've taught you so far, don't do it before the verb rik. In fact, actually, you could even specify that the me before Rick. Actually, I don't know. It could be, you know, I don't know, the person who is ordained is proper. Yeah, it could be. Yeah. So this is the sort of thing we would want to pass on to a human being. Yeah. So here's how we have currently formulated this rule to the computer. If me or ma could be a noun count, which is to say no earlier rule has precluded it, follows a probable genitive, because we haven't distinguished the genitive case marker and the genitive convert yet, does not precede Rick and does not precede a verbal noun, and the word before the possible genitive is not an ambiguous verb, this is, I haven't even mentioned, is to preclude the gi after verbs that can mean something like but yeah. Then mark me slash ma as a noun count. Yeah. And this is an example of, you know, how computers are better than students is the computer is perfectly happy to say, oh, okay, yeah, that's what I'll do. Yeah. And this is how we actually communicate that to the computer in a regular expression. And to me, this is total gobbledygook, but it's what Ed does and provides an essential part in that, because the computer doesn't know English, right? It only knows computer. Okay, so now that was finding me and Ma as nouns, and now I think we're, yeah, well, it's more about me and Ma in any case. So if me or Ma occur before me, it's not going to be negation, even though it's a verb, right? Because me is already negated, sort of in its guts. So then we specify that it's that these are nouns. Also, we use the associative case to find nouns. So for instance, if you had platang mi dro, it could maybe mean someone didn't go with the god, but in our experience, it's usually means that the me is a noun. Yeah. Right, and then we can actually start finding the negation markers. So me, what I do in each of these slides is I present first a morphologically unambiguous example. Yeah, so we have mi jedo, mi shekso. But watch out, because mi kang can either mean not full or which person, right? And then mi sokte is, we saw already, means people. And then we have certain verbal nouns that also seem to happen after people, yeah? So mi gepa, let's say, means a person and doesn't mean not age. It could be either, right? So actually, let's say you have to just trust me that we formulate this very carefully in terms of the general rule and then the exceptions. Mm-hmm. And whenever it could be either, whenever we run an exception, we don't specify it the other way. We don't say, mi gepa, interpret as a noun. We say, mi gepa, don't force an interpretation as negation. And that way, all of the hard ones are passed on to the human beings to look at. Okay. So then, if you have ma before an imperative, then we mark that as negation, as long as none of the preceding rules have applied. Sorry, not ma before imperative. Ma in the prohibitive construction, which is before present tense. Yeah. That's just, I hope everyone knows, when I gave this paper in Leipzig, not everyone knew that. In Tibetan, you don't negate the imperative. You negate the present with ma to form the prohibitions, yeah? So in those situations, we can be pretty sure that this ma is negation. And then otherwise, you know, ma for the past. And then we have to also put in ma yin. And it is true that ma yin can sometimes mean is a mother. But what our approach has been in this situation is to say ma yin means is not. And then if we run into cases where it means is a mother, try to find something from the context that helps us know that, and then write that in as a subrule. Yeah, okay. So I feel like maybe this last part wasn't as clear as it should have been. So we first look for the ma's and me's we know are nouns, and then I showed all the little exceptions to that. And then we look for the ma's and me's that we know are negation, and then I showed all the little exceptions to that. And we apply them in that order. Yeah, we find all the nouns, then we find all the negations, and then when we know it could be tricky, we write in those exceptions, and those are passed on as ambiguous. But the unambiguous cases allow us to sort of build further knowledge, as you'll see in the verb stems. Whereas if the computer's not sure whether the ma is negation or a noun, it can't tell you anything about how it interacts with the following verb stem. Okay, so now I will switch to discussing how we disambiguate verb stems. So in principle, we follow the indigenous grammatical tradition in believing that a Tibetan verb has four stems. There have been some linguists who say certain kinds of verbs only have two stems, but we think the null hypothesis is they have four stems until we've proven to ourselves that they don't. So let's look at how we disambiguate them. First, we'll look at morphology, syntax, and then last, dharasandhi. So morphology is really easy. Some verbs just distinguish them. They just look totally different. Yeah? So J, you know, to do and to kill, all four stems are different, and just looking them up in the dictionary will give you the right stem. So when it's easy, it's easy. But as you know, it's not always easy. There are verbs like shek, where all four stems are the same. There are verbs like ze, where the imperative is different. And there are verbs like kel, where the present, where the past and the future are the same, but the present and the imperative are different. So why am I telling you this? It's because the computer, for instance, will get zo correct. Actually, it's confusing because it could be the noun treasury, yeah? But but let's say it somehow knows it's not a noun. It will know zo is imperative. But ze, it won't know if it's past or future. So that's when we now apply the syntax rules and the dharasandhi rules in order to disambiguate the morphologically ambiguous cases. Okay. So a lot of it, the imperative is a kind of productive place to start because it's kind of strange in various ways. So if we have this imperative converb, I call it the chick or the shik or the zhik, immediately after a verb stem, then you know it's either the prohibitive or it's the imperative. So here I give an example of a morphologically unambiguous verb and then a morphologically ambiguous verb to show you that the construction works, right? So we have chushi, so then if we have sheshi, we know it's imperative. But watch out, because if it has a preceding ma, then it's not imperative, it's present. And also, sometimes like neshik could mean a place, rather than do stay. So these are sort of caveats that we write. Okay. But then we were just talking about the imperative, the prohibitive. So basically in the last slide, just to make it explicit, here what we're doing is we're using the chick to find the imperative. And then we have to write in this ma as an exception, saying don't call it the imperative if there's a preceding ma. And then here we apply another rule, which says if there's a preceding ma and a following chick, then call it the present. Okay, and then the imperative has quite constrained syntax that it operates in, right? So you never have the imperative before na or before kyang and so on. So in all of these circumstances, we you know, pick off imperative as a potential analysis. And then, right, and then this was maybe unnecessary distinction, but these are subordinate clauses, and these are finite clauses. But there are finite clauses also where you know it's not imperative because it's explicitly marked as indicative or explicitly marked as interrogative. And this is the sort of thing you don't actually even have to tell a student, but you have to tell a computer. So if there's a sum or a so, then you take off the interpretation as imperative. Okay. Now, I don't know that this is something the handbooks have, But the future never comes before nay. And this we did with a simple conjure search. For instance, if you look for ja ne, you get something that's either about birds or about barley. You never get sort of having was, you know, I don't even know how to say it. It's probably because it doesn't make any sense. But in any case, future never happens before ne. So if you have something that could be a future, like check ne, then you know it's not a future. And that's where, let's say, this is the first of these cases where distributional phenomena help us in a new way. And what Ed will be showing you, in part at least, is an advanced search facility we have. So rather than do this sort of anecdotal, I'll search with the conjurer, see if I can find a future after a name, we can actually have the corpus generate these patterns so we can know very explicitly and incontrovertibly that something's true, and once we know it's true, then we can force it to be true in contexts where otherwise would have been ambiguous. Yeah. Okay. And now we turn to negation. So that's why it was necessary to sort out the ma and the mi already. So ma comes before the past. So if ma is there, then it's past. Right. And then mi is either present or future. So mi allows you to pull off the interpretation past. And then notice how these things can interact very elegantly, where if you have mi, shek, ne, the ne tells you it's not future, the mi tells you it's not past, which means it has to be present. So there we've won, in a sense. We've narrowed it down from four to a single interpretation. Okay, so now on to Dadarasandhi. This is something everyone should learn in first year Tibetan, but is easy to forget about. After Ra, La, and Na, you can have a Dadra. In Old Tibetan, they sometimes write it, they sometimes don't. In canonical Tibetan, they usually don't. But it's still there and can be felt through its effect in Sandhi contexts. So here I have the non-dadra forms and then the dadra forms. And the dadra is characteristic, let's say, of the past. It doesn't only occur in the past, but it's characteristic of the past. So these are futures and these are pasts. Is everyone on board with this? Okay. So just some caveats to notice. Is it not all past forms that could have a dadra do have a dadra? So jinno, he gave or something like that, is never jinto. But you know, kind of, if I had invented the language, I would have made it jinto. Yeah. And then similarly, the dadra can occur on present stems. So for instance, zin, which is a present, is always jinto and not jinno. So basically, the only thing you can say is that. What I would say is, if you do have a dadra, it's very probably the past, but we don't want to preclude the interpretation as present. The future is right out. Yeah. Okay. So this is just a sort of aside, which is pa should be the dadra form and ba should be the non-dadra form. You may feel like that's pushing it a bit too far. That a pa and a ba look too similar, and you know, the Tibetans, they just throw in pas and bas around. But our feeling is that whether or not the distribution of pa and ba conforms to what you would expect on the basis of Dadarasandhi is a matter to investigate. And you can't investigate it if you ignore it. So what we should do is we should take it on board, apply it, and then see the results it gives and help that help us explore the behavior of pa and ba sandhi in Tibetan. So, I hope that you don't mind. Now, I'm going to discuss the order in which these rules apply. So basically, if you believe that each Tibetan verb stem in a particular context is unambiguous, sort of, in its heart. Yeah, every single verb knows I'm a present, I'm a future. Then all roads should lead to Rome. If you apply Dadra Sunday or syntax, it shouldn't matter. But in practice, it's very important to apply the syntax rules first, and then the Dadra Sunday rules. And here's an example. And because of my poor vision, I'll see if I can ask someone else to read it out loud. Maybe Sam, would you read this example? The Tibetan.
Kamchik Shindu Teba, Tebe Sengi Chu Nyamba, Kangzam Sangila Chutam, Gendun La Pu Lam, Pamala Pu, Lam, Upon La Chine, Jensen La China, Sun Nam Di Ni. Gewa tumar, tumar, what's that on? But no, tumar yang yi sepe.
Okay, that's totally fine. It's quite hard to read, and you did better than I would have. Will someone else take the English? Maybe Charles, can you take the English?
If one with a mind of great faith offers handfuls of water to the Buddha, or makes offerings to the Sangha, or makes offerings to one's parents, or gives to the poor, or gives to wild animals, this merit shall not run out for many eons.
Yeah, nice, good Buddhist sentiment. So, to focus in on the verbs we're interested in, here we have pul, to give, which, morphologically speaking, can be a past or an imperative. Now, it's followed by lam, which is the question mark form, right? Now, if we applied the Dadra rules first, we would say lam is a non-Dadra form, so that means this pool isn't the past. So we'll take off this past and we'll be left with imperative. And that's wrong. Whereas if we apply the syntax rules first, we say lam is the question marker. You don't put a question marker after an imperative, so we knock out the imperative interpretation and then we're left with the past. And then when the Dadra rules come along, they won't even see this example because it's already been decided. Yeah, and then the same happens there. Yeah? Okay. Well, this is just me explaining what I just explained. Yeah? Okay, and now we'll go through a couple more examples similarly. Maybe Abel, will you read the Tibetan? Can you read the Tibetan?
Tibetan?
Yeah. You don't think, Oh, I see. Everyone, I'll just give you a minute. You can read it, or try to read it to yourself. Okay. So, I'll focus in on this, mijor to. So, here the to says it should be past, because it's a dadra form. But the mi says it shouldn't be past. And unlike the previous slide, here, the correct answer is totally unclear to me. Yeah, mijor to shouldn't happen, is the way the grammar books would have you think. But our feeling is, if syntax on the last slide was a better guide than Dadra Sunday, then we should trust the syntax here too. So the mi gets rid of the past, and it's a present, and then when the Dadra Sunday rules come along, they just don't do anything because it's already unambiguous. But I think this is a very interesting example, right? Now we're learning something about Tibetan grammar. You do sometimes have a Dadra Sunday form and me, implying that it's kind of both the past and not the past at the same time. Okay. This is just me explaining what I've just explained. So, in the current system, this turns out as present. Okay, and then here's just one more example of a similar sort of case, where here we have ma sel lam, where the lam tells you that it shouldn't be past, but the ma tells you it should be past. So here we go with past, because that's what the syntax contains. Okay. Now, for some preliminary observations about what we've learned about Dhadra Sandhi, which, yeah, are maybe interesting. Ser never gets a Dhadra. So, if you wanted to hypothesize, for instance, that certain verbs don't distinguish the four stems, this is, you know, this isn't, it's not open and shut, but the fact that Zer never gets a Dhadra is interesting. And then, Den is strangely behaved, and then I will introduce a caveat after saying this. So if you're one step ahead of me, you know, be patient. Den no is always the finite form without a Dhadra. You never get den to. And the nominalized form is den pa, never den wa. This is in the Khandra, let's say. So that's strange because it seems like the Dhadra Sandhi is indexing finite versus nominalized rather than tense, which is bizarre, right? And then those of you who are up on your Sandhi rules will say, no. It's the den is always nominalized with pa, as for instance the Dakyik Sarjak says in its chart of particle Sandhi. But Abel and I looked at this in some detail, and I can tell you that in Old Tibetan, I think particularly in the Ramayana, pa and ba, even with den, definitely is distributing in relationship to the presence of a Dhadra. So if you say, no, Nathan, enough with this ba, pa, Dhadra stuff, it's just always pa after na. It's not in Old Tibetan. So this is actually showing us exactly the power of such a research project, is that in certain documents, in certain old documents, the let's say the to no sandhi is behaving very similarly to the pa ba sandhi. But at some point, the behavior of the Dhadra in different verb forms diverges, so that by classical Tibetan, at least with den, it's indexing the nominalization rather than the tense form. And that there's some story to be told there about the evolution of the Tibetan language, and I think it's a good example because, let's say, a lot of these things maybe you haven't worried about when you read Tibetan, but I have because I'm interested in these sorts of things. But this one is totally new to me. And there's a whole, you know, vista of research questions now about the history of Dhadra Sandhi that we could potentially answer with this corpus. And that would help in doing things like dating when a text is from. Okay. Now, just to say, in verb stem disambiguation, we only go so far. There may be contexts, if you're an intelligent reader of Tibetan, where you would say, oh, no, this is clearly future, that we would decide to leave ambiguous. And the reason to do this is we want the corpus to be very consistent. So we basically let the computer do as much as it can, but on the question of verb stem disambiguation, we don't ask the human being to add any value because we doubt that it could be done consistently. So to give you one example, on a single folio sheet of the Khandra, we have both of these. So in the first one, we have dap raptu yung du sol. Yeah? I request that you give me ordination, where this form is explicitly future. A few lines later, on the same text, we have dap la sanje dichu she du sol. I request that you explain the Buddha Dharma to me. And here, this verb form is ambiguous between present and future. So as a reader of this text, you may say, well, if it's on the same page, it's the same construction. If it's future in the first one, it must be future in the second one. But we don't do that. That requires a level of analysis and interpretation that's too sophisticated for what we're trying to do and is contestable, right? We want to have very solid results. So we just throw up our hands. Although it's not quite true to say we throw up our hands. What we do is we write a little note in our notebook. These are things that we can explore, and then if we find a consistent pattern, we can implement it. You know, if we find out that whenever you have verb du sol, and it can distinguish the future, it does distinguish the future, then we could use that information to force the interpretation of a future in the second sentence. And that's a project that we're actively working on right now.
Okay.
Yeah, I get ahead of myself on the PowerPoint. Okay, so that's it for verb stem disambiguation. The trouble is, in a lot of cases, you won't be able to tell. So something like this quel do, yeah, if that's all you have, then you can't find an unambiguous answer. So we introduce a new tag to make that ambiguity explicit. And the reason why is we can't turn the thing back to the computer until every word has exactly one analysis. Otherwise, it's just, let's say it's a pragmatic problem, a technical problem, but the other way of understanding it is until you have one analysis for every word, the computer would say, well, you haven't done your job yet. You haven't told me how it is. So this is a way of saying, in the first one, we don't know whether it's future and past, and we may still be trying to figure it out. Whereas the second one is saying, we have done everything we can, and in this circumstance, it's impossible to tell the difference, given our current knowledge, and we write that claim explicitly. And that allows us to then submit the thing back to the computer. And for a similar case, something like shekso, it could be any of the three stems. So just in order to keep the tags a little shorter, we call this v-invariant. And I just want to underline that v-invariant does not mean this is a verb that doesn't distinguish these stems. It instead means at this moment in this text, this verb does not distinguish the stems. If we had shekne or mashek or something like that, then we would specify the stem. Okay. But this process of putting the tags together to introduce these ambiguous tags involves a certain danger too. So here we have the verb joue, which the computer looks in my verb dictionary and it says, oh, it could be future, it could be past, it could be present. So then in certain circumstances, it will tag it as joue v invariant, meaning I can't tell the difference between those stems in this case. But this would be a mistake because in fact, the joue future and present belongs to the verb request, and the joue past belongs to the verb melt. So it may look ambiguous to the computer, but to a human reader, you always know whether it means request or melt. So recommending v-invariant would be a mistake. So these cases, we just have to write in some rules at the end of the program to coin a neologism, re-ambiguate these circumstances so that the human user is then forced to choose between these two options, which you can understand as choosing does it mean melt or does it mean request. And then here are just some other examples like that, right? So to itch is invariant, to eat is the present, chi to be is invariant, but as to go, it's the past. So you want to write in rules to force the human being to choose in those circumstances. Okay. And that's the end. But how well is it working? Well, this is as of December 11th. It's showing the operation on two texts. The first line, the lexical tagger, that's just the process of looking up every word in the dictionary. So that leads to 100% accuracy by definition, because if you put every possible interpretation on every word, then you know that the correct interpretation is associated with every word, because it's one of those, yeah? But the ambiguity is very high, which means there, in average on the Zonglun, it's almost 2.5, which means that on average, each word has 2.5 interpretations. So some words have 2, some words have 3, some words have 5, many only have 1, but on average, 2.5. Once we apply the software, we of course pull down the accuracy a little bit. Sometimes the machine makes a mistake, you know, like it decides that some me is negation which should have been a noun. So the accuracy goes down to 0.988, but the ambiguity is pulled down quite a lot, from 2.5 interpretations per word to 1.5 interpretation per word. And we've continued to work since December 11th. And if I remember correctly, I don't know if Ed has these numbers in his mind, we're now at 0.994 for accuracy and 1.36 or something for ambiguity. So we're pulling the accuracy up and we're pushing the ambiguity down. Of course, the trouble is the higher the one gets and the lower, it gets harder and harder, right? So, and we, by design, won't be getting up to an ambiguity of one, because there are many cases where we want a human being to check the work of the computer. Okay, that's it for the rule-based part of speech tagger. I would be happy to take some questions.